out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
And welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday, the 22nd of February, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. It's a beautiful day here in Blighty. What's it like over there, Matt?
Well, as is often the case in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and in winter, it is cloudy.
It's beautiful here. It's a beautiful spring day here. Of course, I've got Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson with me. I forgot to introduce you there, Matt. But I'm glad to hear you're doing well today. I think we've got a very timely podcast, timely subject matter for the listeners today. We're going to be talking a little bit about occult faggotry. Now, I know that you've spoken about this before on other podcasts, Matt. And the other day, I was trying to recall which ones they were, and I couldn't actually think of the titles. So, and then I thought, well, you've never actually done one specifically on this, so it's going to be good, I think, today to do one on it, and then people can then refer back to it as well when they need to.
Yeah, it's something I reference it quite often. You know, especially since E. Michael Jones' book on usury has come out, he has connected it explicitly to usury and thus to alchemy. It's barren metal. It's something that's not supposed to reproduce, that actually is forcibly, just through the alchemy of the mind, made to reproduce. Usury is connected to homosexuality in the sense that it's an unnatural union, and something that is infertile is thought to be fertile. And this was kind of one of the more esoteric reasons for the ancient prohibitions on that practice. And it is connected with oligarchy. It's connected, and it grows in times of great moral stress, where everyone's looking for a strong man to protect them. Homosexuality and transvestitism thrive in chaos.
Well, it's also the exact opposite of marriage. Marriage is sacrosanct. It's one of the sacred rituals of the Catholic Church, and I believe of the Orthodox Church as well. And sodomy is the direct opposite of that. So it's basically turning a sacrament upside down and inversing it. So it's pretty evil. The act in itself is pretty evil. But we've been told that it's people that are just born this way. And as I was searching through for quotes that we could add to this, quotes that you sent to me, Matt, I found one which I thought was really good, because this shows that there is no way that people are born gay. You know, if you believe in God, then there's no way that people can be born gay. And this quote says, "No one is born gay because God doesn't make mistakes. If someone were born gay, then God failed to give them the ability to reproduce and have children as such, and that would mean that God is imperfect." And the whole concept of God, the whole point of God, is that he's a perfect being. And if he was a perfect being, he wouldn't be able to create someone that did not have the ability to reproduce, which is the whole point of life in itself. So if you believe that people are born gay, then you believe that God is imperfect, and therefore he is no God. That's the logic behind that. I think that's a fantastic quote there to begin with, Matt.
Well, it's not a coincidence that all civilizations, with no exception, and this includes the ancient Greek one, at their height, condemned homosexual practices. This might be an aside, but it is a myth that homosexuality, you know, dominated the elite in ancient Greece. I have an article on my own website, rushjournal.org, on the Jewish connections with faggotry. But the Greek city states generally had laws against homosexual unions. Kenadios, which is the term for a gay man, is translated as a cause of shame. And in fact, the Athenian laws say that there no homosexual can have a public position or even be in the civic religion. What often happens is that people want to read what they want into the ancient texts. We live in a society so hypersexualized that any reference to a lover or a body or something like that, or the beauty of a body or the beauty of knowledge, it's automatically sexualized. This is how we've been hardwired now. That wasn't the case back then. I mean, the teacher was the lover, and the beloved was the student in ancient Greece. This was an erotic connection, although not a physical one. But when they write it like that, when it's translated that way and is accurately translated in this society, you know, it sounds like, you know, Freddie Mercury talking to Liberace, you know, but it's not sexual whatsoever. It's not physical at all.
It's like the word attractive, isn't it? Attractive doesn't have to mean sexually attractive. But it seems to mean that today, if you're attracted to something or somebody, then apparently it's a sexual attraction. If you're attracted to somebody, then why not just have sex with them? That's what's encouraged today. And part of this homosexual sexual magic sort of thing is the occult side to it, which doesn't very often get talked about. We often talk about how degenerate it is, how disgusting it is, and how against nature it is. But it's not very often talked about that there's an occult side to this as well. And it came up last week. I did a podcast with Florian Geyer about the pagan laser butt gay disco. And it made it quite clear in that there were occult overtones to it. It was like a witch's coven. And that's because the history of homosexuality goes back into the occult and black magic. And another quote that you sent to me to use, Matt, comes from a book on homosexuality and the Kabbalah. And this quote says, "Homosexuality, like the use of drugs, is one of the techniques of black magic. In the homosexual act, two streams of force are called forth with all the power of the instincts. And as these two streams of force are of the same type, there is no circuit of force possible, so that the combined forces are available for magical direction. It is a much more potent way of working than the use of incubi and succubi, lower elementals of sensuality, which are formed by the solitary technique of fantasies of masturbation." So I guess what that's saying is that these two forces, where it's male and female, that they're joined together to create something good. And if it's not male and female, then if it's two males in this instance, then it's capable of being utilized for something else. Is that what that is suggesting, Matt?
Yeah, it's sort of like the symbol in Freemasonry of the stairway that leads to nowhere. The stairway that leads to just a wall but with no door. Once you remove the pleasure of the act from the purpose of the act, it's now dislodged. It can be used in any way the powerful want it to be. But of course, there's a gendered reason for. I think you'll mention it in a little bit here. There's a gendered reason for this, and that of course is the father figure. And this is, you know, you mentioned in the beginning that there is no biological foundation for it. The truth is that try as they may, no one can deny that male homosexuality as well as female homosexuality is the result of a lack of a father figure. And a lack of a strong father figure. Evelyn Hooker's Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology in 69, Homosexuality and Family Dynamics in 63, Etiological Factors of Homosexuality, as seen in the Royal Air Force Psychiatric Practice, which is the British Journal of Psychology, 1964. You go way back before there was any of this prohibition on criticizing homosexuals. And overwhelmingly, it comes from the lack of a father figure. Now, the father figure is always symbolized by the king, our modern world is based on the killing of the king ritual. Now, this I have had substantial work done very explicitly in podcasts and lectures and everything else. And this is this frustration that the king is dead and the sons are just trying to absorb his essence, so to speak, trying to be kings themselves. And of course, that's republicanism, democracy, which is really oligarchy. So as the power of the king is destroyed, the sons attempt to suck some of that down. No, I think, that's come up in the literature as well.
Well, that comes up a little bit later on in this. I mean, I could read that out now, and what you're referring to, that's from E. Michael Jones. This is a quote from E. Michael Jones, and he refers to this. He says, "Since sex for the homosexual is essentially an attempt to appropriate the masculinity that he feels lacking in himself from someone who seems to embody it, sex with girls has no purpose, since girls do not have what he lacks. Once it gets construed in this way, sex becomes essentially a vampiric act. It is either sucking the desired object to obtain its male essence, or being sucked for the same purpose. Isherwood makes this vampiric character clear, but in a slightly veiled manner. When he talks about Booby, the first object of his homosexual attentions in Berlin," and then it has a quote from the author writing about Booby. "Christopher wanted to keep Booby all to himself forever, to possess him utterly, and he knew that this was impossible and absurd. If he had been a savage, he might have solved this problem by eating Booby for magical, not gastronomic reasons." Close quote. "Like a vampire, the homosexual draws off the power from another by sucking, by draining the desired object of its life force and absorbing into himself in some ritualistic, magical banquet. Of course, this magic never works. In fact, it only exacerbates the loneliness and inadequacy which drove the homosexual to this form of sexual activity in the first place. And so what arises, in place of the magic, is a compulsive, addiction-like, vicious circle, in which the homosexual tries to compensate for a sense of masculine inadequacy by engaging in homosexual activity, which, once it is over, only makes the inadequacy seem even worse." So it's a lack of self-discipline and self-control as well, I would say, Matt. You're saying it's a lack of a strong father figure. It's a lack of self-discipline. You know, for them to say people are born like this, they just can't help themselves. Well, we get celibate priests. They take oaths never to have sex in their lives, and they don't, the majority of them. And this, for years, people would take vows for celibacy, but that just seems to have gone out the window now that homosexuality is a trendy fad, and nobody is expected to remain celibate. And surely, if they really didn't want to be this way, then they don't have to actually act on their desires. It's the acting on the impulse that makes it wrong. It's once the action actually takes place. You know, the thoughts that the mind has, you don't have that much control over, but you do have control over your actions. That's the main problem with it, I think.
Well, there's never been uncovered a shred of biological evidence for homosexuality. This is a social problem. And I know you may have heard of, I think his first name is Robert Nicolosi, who died recently, who ran a former homosexual who is also a clinical psychiatrist and psychologist, who had a practice to, you know, bring homosexuals out of that perversion into a normal lifestyle. These men were well aware of the cause of their homosexuality, the searching for this kingly figure, this archetype of the strong protector, that on the one hand they need, but on the other hand they resent, because it puts limits on their behavior. And these are connected. The fact is that because he's cured thousands of homosexuals from their mental illness, he's proven clinically that it's a psychological condition and not a biological condition. But I think the key occult aspect of this, the deepest of the occult aspect of this, is the concept of the king. The male father figure could be, you know, the father of the family. It could be a great warrior leader. It could, but ultimately, it's monarch or God the Father himself. And we sinful people, you know, we need this discipline. We need the source of natural law. We can't function without it. And yet, of course, we resent it because we don't like being told what to do. So the murder of the king is attempt to become little kings ourselves. And that's the nature of modernity. That's the nature of republicanism. Now, the king is killed. All Republicans, you know, the king is killed. And so the power that normally would be given to a monarch is given to an oligarchy, which is another way of saying that the power that would normally belong to a monarch is given to the power of money. And hence, again, we started off with the mention of usury, which sounds very, very esoteric, but that's the connection. You know, the death of the king is the nature of republicanism. It's the nature of modernity. In, you know, in Genoa and in Venice, Novgorod, these commercial cities, Tyre in the Old Testament, Carthage, they're all based on the same notion of radical individualism, of nominalism. And they're opposed by monarchies. They're opposed by systems where God the Father is recognized. It isn't like they don't recognize him. They just hate him here. And so the origin of cannibalism and the war of all against all is when, you know, the wealthy sons of the king don't want to be told what to do anymore. But once they kill him, they realize that there is no unity anymore. Their own source of authority has failed. And you mentioned the very last line of what you just quoted there, is that it never works. It just increases their inadequacy. They're trying to find their foundation, their basis, in a father, but they've killed him. And they're trying to, as you say, as a vampire, you know, a vampire does kill its victims. Suck the life out of someone. And so it's connected with vampirism. It's connected with cannibalism. It's connected with human sacrifice. And it's connected with everything that is unnatural. But the ultimate foundation is the destruction of monarchy in the broad sense of the term.
It certainly never started out as a sexual orientation. It was always about dominance and submission. And it still is in non-Western cultures. It's still about dominance and submission. I mean, these Afghanis that rape little boys, they certainly wouldn't see themselves as homosexuals. They are totally against homosexuality, but they rape little boys. They don't see that as being homosexual. That's a domination and submission thing. And this started back way back in the ancient pagan mystery religions. And this is another quote that we've got here. Homosexuality and pedophilia were popularized in the ancient pagan mystery religions. Worshippers of Baal erected shrines and temples of male prostitution. Roman emperors Nero, Caligula, and Commodus engaged in incest, sex with boys, bondage, and a variety of evil crimes. So too did those in Pharaoh's court. Alexander the Great was a homosexual who loved little boys. When the Spanish conquistadors conquered Central America and the Yucatan in Mexico, they found that most native Indian priests were sodomites. In their pagan temples were sacred statues depicting gay sex acts. In Babylon, people sacrificed and prayed to gods and goddesses, requesting sexual favors and carnal pleasures. Now, we hear a lot about the sexual favors and the orgies and the hieroguli, these whores that were in the temples, but they don't often tell you about the sodomy that was going on there. You very rarely hear of that, do you?
This is why the prohibition in the book of Leviticus exists. It seems to be a very odd thing. You know, people complain that, oh, the Bible doesn't mention anything too much about homosexuality. And, of course, the answer to that is because it was, you know, for the common person, universally condemned. They didn't really need to discuss it all that much. The only time it comes up is in the pagan cults. And these are, as you mentioned, more about domination. You see this in the animal kingdom as well. They're, you know, the mere fact that the penis is being used doesn't automatically make it sexual, which is really hard for you know, we moderns to comprehend, but it's true. It doesn't automatically make it a sexual act. It's a ritualistic act. With all these societies that you mentioned, they're unnatural because they're based on oligarchy. They're based on money. You know, Egypt was a commercial power, despite the fact that it had a pharaoh. It had a pharaoh that was highly limited by these very same priests that we're talking about. So I don't want to say that the mere existence of a monarch automatically means that this is – no, the monarch could be a sham. The monarch could be a fraud. It's not just a father figure, but it has to be a strong father figure. It has to be a father figure that not only can set limits but explain to you why those limits need to be there. So they love them and they hate them at the same time.
So it's a usurping of the father figure and a hatred of the father figure and the self-discipline that is male and associated with the patriarchy. And it's also a hatred of God. It's a desecration of the life-creating substance that male bodies produce. I mean, it's a desecration of it. It's putting it in the worst place you can think of. It's putting it in a sewer pipe. And this is what God has given us to create life with. And these people think it should be put in a sewer pipe. And they do that at the same time as carrying out these rituals to these demons and these idols in the past. And it wasn't just in the Middle East, these Egyptian Canaanite type idolatry either. I mean, this happened in Europe as well with the Knights Templar. When the Knights Templar came back from the Middle East, they have become contaminated by all of this. We've got another quote here about the Knights Templar. In the Knights Templar rituals, a crucifix of Jesus was reviled and urinated on. So there we go. There we have this rejection of Christianity, rejection of God. And homosexual orgies were rumoured. Strangely, the seal or coat of arms of the order depicted two knights riding on one horse. Was this an emblem of their homosexual passion, or, as the Templars protested, a statement of their brotherly love? And buggery was actually one of the charges, the official charges that were made against the Templars. And when these charges were made, they did confess to them. And there's about a dozen that were actually made. But charge number three was that the receptors practiced obscene kisses on new entrants, on the mouth, navel, or buttocks. And charge number three was that the brothers encouraged and permitted the practice of sodomy. And most Templars confessed that they didn't believe in Jesus because they held him to be a false prophet. Well, I wonder where they got that from. Probably the Muslims. They also confessed that they had committed acts of homosexuality during the admission ceremony as well as afterwards. That they also worshipped idols and practiced Satanism. And all these admissions entered the court records. And following their trial, most of the Templars were imprisoned. They were also accused of worshipping a head, the head of Baphomet, and worshipping a goat. So you've got Satanism, you've got the reviling of Jesus Christ, and you've also got sodomy, all being carried out by this secret society. They're just carrying on the same thing that we were talking about just earlier, Matt, with the Egyptian ones and the Canaanite ones, I think, but just in more modern times. And these people have evolved, the Knights Templar have evolved into the Freemasons, and the Freemasons, as we know, are in the part of the elite of society and the aristocracy. This is where it all originates from. It's got nothing to do with, two people that love each other should be allowed to marry each other regardless of their gender, or all this is just about love. It's about a rejection of the fundamental principles of nature and a rejection of God and a rejection of the patriarchy, I would suggest.
Well, the patriarchy is the basis of all knowledge and stable truth. It's something that, you know, commercial capitalism despises. The early republics or commercial empires were based on the constant seeking for profit. Having universal standard truths, which implies, you know, one ruler, that there is one source for all of these, that there is a final foundation where the buck stops completely, is absolute anathema to commercial capitalism. They need everything in chaos. They need everything, constant movement, constant change, constant innovation. And then, of course, everything is based not so much on reason, but the passions. homosexuality is about far more than just two men. Although, you know, I hate the fact, you know, one of the worst things about this whole issue is that we have to think about it. And you know, that's bad enough. So we have to use euphemisms because it's disgusting. But, you know, that's, you know, they've almost won in that sense that they forced us to think about it and consider it. But this is, you know, the male orgy is the essence of a republic. It is the dominant males following their passions. What difference does it make whether it's sexual or political or economic? It's essentially all one and the same thing, but they have all one common enemy, and that's truth. The one being, the one father that could put a limit on what they do, and that's why they despise God so much. They despise, and I would say it didn't come from so much from Islam, but it came from Judaism, because the Talmud, as you know, overthrows the Old Testament proscription of homosexuality, and in fact enshrines it. And there's a whole Jewish literature going way back that supports the pagan homosexual rights right within Judaism itself. So as far as the Talmud is concerned, and of course this is also connected with the Babylonian Talmud, their own experiments with magic and usury. Wherever you go, you get the exact same sets of connections. Wherever usury is and commercial capitalism is, you have an oligarchy. Wherever you have an oligarchy, there's the hatred of any monarch, of the common good. Everything is about pursuing your own private good. And then once all standards are in flux, anything goes. And the only thing that rules are passions. I mean, well, what is the point of reason if there is no absolute truth? It's just rationalization at this point. Reason is just logic. It's just a way that we can pursue our ends as effectively as possible. But it has no purpose than that. If there's no absolute truth, then reason is useless. So ultimately, commercial capitalism and usury creates homosexuality, or really the notion of fornication in general, the notion that the passions rule. This is somehow a natural way to be, and whoever can put their stamp on society with the most force is automatically the winner. And remember, Baphomet himself is a sexual figure. It has male and female features. It's a transvestite. It's a crossdresser. Wherever you go, you get the same series of traits.
That features a lot in alchemy, doesn't it? The union of the two opposites, and also in the Kabbalah, and you can see these transsexual figures right in front of you, and where people are trying to think of the what it means esoterically and the occult side of it, it just slips past them that what they're actually looking at is a he-she. They're looking at one of these transsexual monsters that we are told are just the same as us. And yet when we see them, they're really messed up, mentally disturbed individuals that want to mutilate themselves. And that figures in so much of the alchemy imagery and the Kabbalah imagery. It's all about the union of the opposites. And that's where it finds itself, is in this homosexuality that, as you say, goes hand in hand together with capitalism and usury. I think you made a good point there about the origin in Judaism. And I said it's probably Islam, because they were talking about Jesus being a false prophet. And I don't think the Jews even acknowledged that he was a false prophet. I mean, they just totally blaspheme him. But it definitely would have been a Jewish influence as well. And they do have to flaunt it. That's what this gay pride is about. They have to flaunt it. They have to force it down our throats. We have to see this. We have to be sickened by it, because that way it makes them feel that it's okay for them to do it, because they're doing it out there in the public, and we're not stopping them. And they have to use the whole strength of the police force and the threat of the law against us and homophobia to get us to not react to it. And then they can flaunt it in front of us and pretend to themselves that it's all perfectly okay. Just before we finish, Matt, I'd like to just bring up the subject of gay marriage, where we're told, oh, it's just two men that love one another. Well, homosexuals used to mock marriage. They used to pretend to be women, and they would go to their molly houses in the 18th and the 19th centuries, and they would ridicule marriage. That was the whole point of it, was ridiculing marriage. The gay marriage, two men together, they would mock the marriage ritual, and then they would bugger one another in front of everybody there. And that was their marriage. That was their marriage ritual. And now they've succeeded in blaspheming and mocking the traditional marriage ritual by saying that marriage is now the same as sodomy, because it used to be the act, they consummate the marriage act. It was the sacred act between a man and a woman that produces life. And now it means the same thing as sodomy. It means the complete opposite of it. It's a total lie that it's just two men that love one another. Matt, do you have anything that you'd like to add before we finish?
Oh, this is such a giant topic. One thing I want to mention is that the leadership in the homosexual rights movement is exclusively Jewish. There is no movement, and I have a partial list of them on my site. There is no movement that's so purely Judaic as homosexuality. This is deeply ingrained in their neurosis. Everybody who's anybody in that movement from the 70s onward is Jewish. And this is, you know, is extremely important, and it's found in both in the Kabbalah as well as the Talmud. The list is so ridiculously long, and they're also closely connected with the elites, the corporate elites of America, that the connections that we've been trying to make in this program are blatant. And well, just in the last few years, all of a sudden, yeah, you can mutilate yourself, and that's perfectly okay. And how few people are questioning that, even intelligent people. It shows you the control that these people have and what capitalism has done to our people.
It's very important to them that they promote it, isn't it? And as you say, Matt, we really couldn't do this subject justice in a half-hour program, but I think we've certainly had a good go at it anyway. Thanks for coming on today, Matt. I'll be back tomorrow with another edition of The Daily Nationalist for you. Thank you for listening. God bless and hail victory. Oh,